paper 39, which is on old single column, page 426. Okay, so we finished up the first of this pair of papers on the angels. Remember what we did last session? We, after having done the intro on the seraphim, they gave us a little overview of the cherubim, and then a brief little overview of the midwayers, who in that spot in the book are serving as a placeholder for the unrevealed subordinate order of angels that would normally be in that spot below the cherubim. But there's a truth to them giving a little bit about the midwayers in that spot, because they do in part function kind of in a ministering spirit mode, but they aren't literally ministering spirits. So having done that little kind of survey, then now they're zeroing in on all the almost endless, it seems, details about the seraphim. Recall that when we were when they introduced the cherubim last time, in passing, they mentioned that the cherubim and sanabim are the faithful and efficient aids of the seraphic ministers, and all seven orders of seraphim are provided with these subordinate assistants. And someone asked, what's the seven orders? Well, this is it. Okay, this paper proceeds to step us through one at a time those seven orders. You can see right there at the beginning of the preface here in paper 39, they give you the category names for each of those seven orders. And, you know, they're not going to be mentioning the cherubim, but, you know, that's why I went back and reminded you that. You know, all the stuff we're going to read, you have not only the cherubim and sanabim helping out as assistants all these various orders of seraphim, but there's probably all kinds of other unrevealed beings. There's unrevealed angels that might be interacting in, you know, in indirect ways, and then just completely unrevealed offspring of the infinite spirit probably too as well. So there's probably a vast complexity behind each of these sort of fronts, you know, the seraphic foot forward on a whole vast effort. And so we're just going to be looking at, you know, what's sort of leading that particular effort in these seven different ways. I think that's probably all we need. Why don't we jump in and see what they have to offer us here.
Paper 39, the Seraphic Hosts. As far as we are cognizant, the Infinite Spirit, as personalized on the local universe headquarters, intends to produce uniformly perfect seraphim. But for some unknown reason, these seraphic offspring are very diverse. This diversity may be a result of the unknown interposition of evolving experiential deity. If so, we cannot prove it. But we do observe that when seraphim have been subjected to educational tests and training discipline, they unfailingly and distinctly classify into the following seven groups. 1, supreme seraphim. 2, superior seraphim. 3, supervisor seraphim. 4, administrator seraphim. 5, planetary helpers. 6, transition ministers. 7, seraphim of the future.
Okay. Now, that little intro they gave you before the list, you notice that they're in the mode that they always are. If they can't, you know, directly, definitively prove something, you know, which means they have direct observational access to all the doings and can measure and analyze and definitively step through the causality of the phenomenon, they won't make a definitive statement. But, and so they say this diversity may be the result. Well, but then they, proceed to tell you, what it may be the result of. Because as far as any one can comprehend, there really is only one possibility to make sense out of the phenomenon. If you are watching the very overt existential deity phenomenon, downstepping as you notice they've purposely said the infinite spirit as personalized on the local universe headquarters, instead of saying the creative mother spirit, they hearkened you back, to the top of this phenomenon. If they can't see that existential deity of the infinite spirit in a very overt way, directly manifesting all the details, then they can't reach that definitive conclusion. And what it always is, like we've pointed out a number of times, you have invisible to precise analysis, the coalescence out of the whole of experiential deity. In contrast to that existential deity, that's the phenomenon that is the only logical possibility, short of something that not even the highest of finite beings have any clue about, but barring that, if you're going to have a phenomenon where obviously there's a complexity of selves that's manifested that coincidentally is just what you need to match all of the vicissitudes that are going on in the local universe, everyone is very suspicious that this is that top-down point of view of experiential deity that knows the end from the beginning, basically, not to mention the master architects and that kind of transcendent perspective on things, but that you have, that variableness, which from a, just in front of your face, finite point of view seems to be kind of quasi-random. It's like, well, okay, there's that, some of those, and there's some of those, I'm not sure why. But from a top-down point of view of experiential deity, there's a hand that, he basically called the hand of providence, that knows exactly what it's up to. And it's making sure that you're always going to have just what you need when you need it, because it's a whole. It's not a collection of parts that have to, frenetically try to keep in touch with each other. It's all fundamentally a singular organic system, that can't help but be coordinated. And to have all of this delightful, quote unquote, coincidence, embedded in it, but what it actually is supremacy. There's always supremacy in play. All right, so you remember how when we were reading about seraphim in general, how they were put through an initial training regimen. So they're reminding you that they go through that training regimen and they come out of it categorized. You try to train them and you discover their specificity. And so they end up being in these categories. And sure enough, the first category is supreme seraphim. I'm just mentioning that supremacy. So you have a highest level category in terms of the basic nature of the self of these angels that is able to hit the ground running at the ceiling levels. It doesn't have to go through a whole bunch of experiential development to get up to being able to function up there. That is possible as well, but you obviously need a group that can just hit the ground running at the top level, dealing with those issues that are the most holistic relative to the finite, the supreme seraphim, and then a whole hierarchy stepping down through that. Now, another thing to remind you of why, you know, they say may be the result, but it seems pretty definitive. How many categories do you have? 7. Okay. You know, and again, is this the sevenfoldness like the seven master spirits? No. This is the sevenfoldness like the seven circuits of Avona. This is the Paradise Trinity's sevenfoldness. I go, oh yeah, that's another reason why they started that first sentence the way they did. So here it is again. I've been pointing it out through all these papers that we've been going through in the early part of the book here. Time and time again, fundamentally, to understand what's going on, you have to remind yourself that there is an immutable linkage between the infinite spirit and the Paradise Trinity. And there's a fundamental pairing at the highest level. Everything that they do in that pairing. Not the conjoint actor, but the impersonal side of the third source and center, the infinite spirit, linked to the Paradise Trinity. And they're always functioning in that fundamental linkage. Sometimes one is kind of leading and the other is behind the scenes and vice versa. Sometimes it's, you know, very much hand in hand that they're manifesting. But that fundamental linkage between the two is always in play. Experiential deity stems from the Paradise Trinity. See, so that's what you're seeing here, they believe we're seeing here, is another manifestation of how, a high source of existential deity, is right there paired up with the source of experiential deity, so that you can have this phenomenon where, there's an unseen hand, that which stems down from the Paradise Trinity. And what's the most obvious way that the Trinity can be involved? I mean, whose children are these? You know, they aren't literally the children of the Infinite Spirit. You know, they're the children of the Creative Mother Spirit, which is not just spirit-type deity, downstepped from the Infinite Spirit. It's also mother-type deity, stemming from the Paradise Trinity. See, so there's a very direct conduit for that patterning of the Paradise Trinity to be involved in this process, sort of, you might say in a recessive way, in a behind the scenes way. Okay. All right. So that's the phenomenon, and so you have, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, categories here. Tied to the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of the Paradise Trinity. Now, it's just like we've said so many times, you could wonder, okay, is Supreme Seraphim tied to the first circuit of Avona or the seventh circuit of Avona? You know, that pattern. You know, there's a world on the first circuit that's tied to, one of these, and there's a world on the second circuit that's tied to the second of these, etc. You know, all those, and we've said so many times, you've got all these different sevenfold patterns that you can make as you step out through the circuits, of Havona, right? So, a lot of times it's not at all immediately apparent, how you line them up, but you always want to kind of be thinking about that, because there might be something that you could see. If you just remind yourself, well, can I see that something, a pattern of the seven circuits that I recognize here? Well, the more you know about the seven circuits, the more you might, recognize that pattern. But it's always important to just kind of keep that in mind, wondering, are the seraphim of the future tied to the first circuit or the seventh circuit? All right. Let's get some more here.
To say that anyone seraphim is inferior to an angel of any other group would hardly be true. Nevertheless, every angel is at first service limited to the group of original and inherent classification. My seraphic associate in the preparation of this statement, Manosha, is a supreme seraphim and one time functioned only as a supreme seraphim. By application and devoted service, she has, one by one, achieved all seven of the seraphic services, having functioned in well nigh every avenue of activity open to a seraphim, and now holds the commission of Associate Chief of Seraphim on Urantia.
Okay. And so that's kind of fun that you get that little bit of behind the scenes, but you know, for an obvious reason, you know, it's like, oh, case in point, the seraphim that's working with me here. You know, we know Manosha from a number of places. You know, as was just read there, the associate chief of seraphim. You know, and this is one of those etymologies that's pretty straightforward to sleuth. Now, remember, we've got a very special circumstance on this planet. Since Pentecost, you know, since Michael set up the very special government, scenario, I guess I should say, on this planet, we've had a primary Supernaphim as the chief of Seraphim. Okay, because of the rebellion status, it isn't fully resolved yet. You know, so you have, it's an angel that's in charge of the Seraphim, but, you know, it's a very high angel, one that doesn't fundamentally embody a closeness to humans that the Seraphim innately do, like we've, you know, like they've been reminding us in the previous paper that this is so important, that they're, you know, very close to us. And so they appreciate very immediately our thought processes and our emotions, our feelings, etc. You know, can relate very naturally. You know, and a Supernaphim is not going to be like that. It's going to be, you know, way above us in many ways. You know, and we're going to be kind of inscrutable in a number of ways. You know, so you have this angel that, you know, is like that, that's in charge, and so it's important to have an assistant that can supply that Supernaphim with that immediacy of understanding. Yeah. That etymology there, the OT part in that name is short for OTO. You drop the second O and you put it before a vowel, that's Odo. You know, like otoscope, I mean, that's ear, okay? Yeah, it's the one, the IA, the one who has a human ear, you know, the mankind, okay? You know, because you have a Supernaphim that has a divine ear, okay? But you need someone in charge of the angels who has a human ear, and so they very purposely coined a name like that to remind you of that. And you say, well, yeah, but it's a supreme Supernaphim, that's really high up, yes, but, you know, what else did they say? It's also served all the way down in the, you know, in the hierarchy. You know, she has served all the way down in the hierarchy. So, has, you know, all this vast experience, definitely knows us very well, you know, in many different ways down at our level. So it's a great representative for us. You know, a great voice for us, an ear that hears our pleas, if you will, you know, our needs. You know, they're not, you know, running around trying to make us happy, but it isn't that way that they hear our pleas, you know, but nonetheless, you know, is sympathetic to where we are very directly. All right, now the well-nigh every avenue of activity. We'll get to that a little bit as we get into the details here of the different groups. But it's important, you know, we'll see that there are some groups of angels that are very specialized. Okay, so an angel like Manosha can't just do anything. There are some limitations, as we'll see. But, you know, well nigh every avenue. I mean, effectively every avenue. All right, let's see. I guess maybe the one other thing to stress again, so you don't forget, Every angel has an absolutely unique personality. So this categorizing doesn't have anything to do with their personality. That's not categorizable, in sevenfoldness ways or any other way. Okay, it's their selves. They have a particular flavor of self that is discovered through the training. That self has has initial abilities that are just innate. Just like we have different types of cells and with abilities that are just innate. Music or whatever. It's just you're proficient at it. Much more than the normal individual just by nature. And in many ways, people, you're going to have a hard time through nurture matching you. For no other reason, it's a very short life here. But you give the angels who have a very open-ended lifespan, millions and millions and millions and millions of years, billions and billions and billions of years, and they can become just as proficient at something that at some ability that some angel had just by construct, by nature. Okay? Yep. Yeah, yeah.
John will be here at 120. So we don't really know what our unique thing is. But when we get up there to the mansion worlds, then we'll start learning more about what we were meant to do or what
proclivity. Very much so, because of course, it's your soul that's resurrected, and you don't even know really, what the proficiencies of that other self are. You can maybe guess a little bit that it obviously has something to do with your higher nature, but that's so embryonic and vague right now. We won't be able to really begin to know ourselves until we can see ourselves. Our true selves and our true potentials are pretty much invisible here. So we are working, trusting, in that future. And during this life, it's just, there's a reason why we're not called ascending sons right now. We're called faith sons. There's very little that can be seen right now by us. It has to be that unseen grasp of faith that you are trusting, gives you a relationship to eternity, and that it's not what you can see and experience in any immediate way that somehow bespeaks of your glorious eternal nature. But it's the case that that Morantia self, as it develops, becomes more and more of a self that has similarities to these angelic selves, as we're pointing out, and eventually you're in many ways very similar. Okay, so that's one of the things that this is sort of speaking to indirectly. Just because we ascend through a long hierarchy doesn't mean that we somehow become some kind of a regimented, interchangeable set of parts. Okay, certainly, if I ascend all the way up to the level of the peaks of these seraphim, there's still all kinds of potential for differential. There's these seven major categories, and there's all kinds of subcategories we're about to read. There's all kinds of definitive variability of self that has to do with your relationship to experiential deity, and that's in combination with your absolutely unique personality that has to do with your relationship to existential deity. See, and those two are being brought together. The point is not just to manifest your personality. There's not just existential deity. You're not just about being a son of existential deity. You're also about being a child of experiential deity. Yourself is just as important as your personality, you know, and its special characteristics that are separate from your personality. You know, that's why it's so, self-destructive to get into that long-held idea that, you know, religionists have, that you somehow need to reject yourself. You know, that somehow yourself is either evil, you know, or at least negative, even if it's an original sin or anything like that, it may just be that it's of the earth, you know, and needs to somehow be sloughed off, you know, that you have some sort of higher nature that, you know, is your true self, and, you know, that's so false, so false, okay? You can't get anywhere in this universe as half a fact, okay? You're just as much related to experiential deity as existential deity. You need to have an equal grip on both. You know, that's why there's two consecrations: consecrating your will to the perfect will of God the Father, and just as much, consecrating your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. If you aren't doing both of those, you aren't real. And you know, just think about it practically. Experiential deity, the Mother, is not upholding your personality. That doesn't need to be upheld. That's not a thing. It's upholding yourself. If you'd like to be upheld, you should think about yourself, not your personality. I mean, yes, your personality is there to, you know, do its role in relating you to eternity, but you're in time. You need someone to uphold you in time. Yourself is in time. You know, that's what you need to take care of, that it's worthy of being held. Yep.
Self is not ego.
See, now the word ego, literally means self. The problem is people have come to use the word ego as a synonym for egotism. Okay, which it is not, literally. I mean, literally what the word ego means is your self-aware self. Okay? See, that's the problem. See, the more that you start to think in these false dichotomies, it's like, I need to reject my ego. Well, what you're doing is, unwittingly, you're rejecting yourself. And you can forget about growth. You can forget about any relationship to the cosmos. You know, you're putting yourself in forced suspended animation. That's what I was saying. It's such a corrosive thought that's developed in mankind, where, you know, this idea that the word ego is purely a negative word. You know, it's just like thinking that the word discrimination is a purely a negative word. Just as corrosive to your relationship to the cosmos. And so the revelators are trying to get us, you know, out of that false spiritual bias dichotomy mode that is so anti-self. Yeah, and just think about how ridiculous it is. I mean, if you succeed in being absolutely anti-self, what's that called? It's called iniquity. you're wanting to be spiritual, so you're trying to be really anti-self. Well, so you're actually going in the opposite direction. You're driving yourself unwittingly toward iniquity. You know, you aren't actually in sin or iniquity yet. You're in an ignorant mode. You will get to evil in that mode. You know, in trying to be good and rejecting the self, you will inexorably go to evil. You know, and once you start to disrupt your mind by unwittingly giving badness form in your mind like that, thinking it's good, it starts to get broken enough where you cross the line into sin. You know, that's the mechanics of what happened with Lucifer. That's why they give you all those details about Lucifer. You know, he didn't start out sinning. He started out with the highest ideals, I mean, higher ideals than we can even imagine, trying his absolute best to do good. You know, he was doing what he thought was good, but it was bad. But he didn't notice that until he got in a ways. Then he goes, then, you know, he's encircled in the Holy Spirit. And eventually his discriminator said, that's bad. Oh, dear, it is. Now I see it. I didn't see that before.
Let's just keep that quiet.
Well, except he already went public. So he can't keep it quiet. So now, does he have the courage to admit he was a doofus? No, he doesn't have the courage. And so now he starts consciously choosing that which he knows is bad. Okay? And his mind is already twisted enough that he rationalizes that that's best, you know, for everything. You know, and as soon as you start sinning, you know, consciously choosing what you know to be bad, it doesn't take many steps, and then you're just so hopelessly twisted that, you know, every black is white and white is black, and there's just almost no coming back. You know, you see everything in the opposite. You know, so someone could put a giant good thing in front of you, and it looks drippy, ugly, bad to you. Yeah, just a second. We got a question over here first. Barbara, didn't you have one? No? Okay.
I did.
Oh, you had one? Okay.
Yeah. So the difference between self and selfish.
Yeah. Right. So self is just a neutral word describing your mindful self. You have a circumscribed relationship to the mind energy system that you can work in. That's your self. Okay. Now, when you start talking about the various temperaments of that self, okay, you could use a word like selfish. So now think about that word selfish. God made every single child of God initially selfish. I mean, there isn't any, you know, 1, 2, 3, you know, 4-year-old that isn't innately selfish. That's the way we all start. Okay, we all start out egoistic, self-centered, self-oriented. You know, one of the first words is mine, right? So that's where you start. That's the way God made you. So it's not evil, it's just the way you start as an evolutionary being. The problem is if you take that self-centered consciousness beyond its natural early developmental years, you know, take it past its biologic expiration date, okay? And then egoism becomes egotism, okay? Egotism is problematic. Egoism is just natural. I mean, do you beat your 2-year-old when he says mine? I mean, how ignorant would that be? Okay, but do we have problems with a 40-year-old who the only word he knows is mine? Okay, yeah, we call that egotism. And we've started to say, you know, that's ego. See, and that's a problem. You're losing an important word if you equate ego and egotism, like is so often done. Yeah. Ego is just the Latin word for self, you know, and it's even a little bit more than self. It's the self-aware self. It's the pronoun capital I, you know, is the word ego. Do you want to be a personalized self, a capital I? Yes. That's what the Father would like you to be. That's why the Father gave you a personality. So you could be self-conscious, a self-aware self. I mean, the ego is not evil. It's God-constructed. okay, yep.
Doesn't the Grinch book use self and ego interchangeably throughout?
Yeah, basically yes. I mean, a lot of times you're just using ego in that philosophic Latin sense of as a synonym for self. Without going, I mean, there, you know, and you've got to get into all the various details. There's sometimes that there's a use that kind of shades towards psychoanalysis. You know, where you have the id, the ego, and the superego, you know, and so that's a little bit different use of the word ego. But you know, in general, just start there. Start, you know, it's a philosophic text. Start by thinking, okay, do they just mean, you know, in the way that philosophers have historically used that word, is a that means self. You know, start there. All right. Let's see. We were right there. Let's see. So there was, we got off on Minota and everything there. Okay, I think we did all that. There was just one other quick little comment I was going to make there. You know, bringing up those classifications. You know, you see them doing it. To say that any one seraphim is inferior, that's a challenge to us that I point out frequently. To be destined to be a finaliter doesn't make you superior to someone who isn't destined to be a finaliter. It's just different, okay? But it's very easy to slip into that mode that you're more important if you're sitting next to Jesus than if you're sitting two seats away. You can't make the supreme without planetary helpers and transition ministers. You can't just make the supreme out of the activities of supreme seraphim. Okay, it takes the whole structure, high and low. They're all equally important to the whole. There isn't a single automaton in the universe of universes that's less indispensable than you are to the wholeness of the supreme. Every single part is indispensable to the whole. Okay. If you want to exercise your spiritual consciousness, do it in that full-on way. You want to look for some way to apply equality, there's how to do it. Okay. You know, in relative to the whole, the unity of the whole, everything in being is equal. That's the pure form of, of exercising your spiritual consciousness in that word equality. And then you bring in your material consciousness and get some cosmic consciousness going, and you recognize, yes, but in time and space, it's a system. And it's three-dimensional. It has high and low and near and far, and and so it takes all kinds of different flavors. Okay, some that sweep the ceiling and some that sweep the floor, and everything in between. And so you form an equitable system. But relative to the whole, they're all equal. All right.
Human beings sometimes find it hard to understand that a created capacity for higher level ministry does not necessarily imply ability to function on relatively lower service levels. Man begins life as a helpless infant. Hence, every mortal attainment must embrace all experiential prerequisites. Seraphim have no such pre-adult life, no childhood. They are, however, experiential creatures, and by experience and through additional education, they can augment their divine and inherent endowment of ability by the experiential acquirement of functional skill in one or more of the seraphic services.
So just we were pointing that out before. So you can bring skill up to the level that it matches an innate ability through lots of effort. But let's do that first part that they're saying is might be kind of puzzling to us. Remember how we pointed out that for long spans of time for seraphim in general, they're a very horizontal being, a very stationary being. They're not ascending or descending, per se. Very precisely so. You make a planetary helper, say, and there's this thin, level in the hierarchy that they exist in. They don't know anything about what's above it, and they don't know anything about what's below it. All they know is what's in that thin slab of their nature. They can't imagine above that. They can't imagine below that. And it's especially the below part that is, like they're saying, that's kind of puzzling for us. It's like, well, if you have a, if you're a supreme seraphim, couldn't you just like do anything? No, all they can do is the ceiling sweeping stuff. You know, they have no idea how to, you know, to work the broom on the floor. You know, you hand it to them and, you know, and they look like a complete idiot trying to, you know, trying to do the job down at that lower level. They just cannot comprehend. See, so that's another way to understand how there's an equality here. You know, and that they aren't superior in, you know, in some simple-minded sense. Those ones at the lower levels razzle-dazzle the ones at the higher levels, you know, and when those higher level ones watch what the lower level ones are doing. So are they really lower? Or are they all, in that sense, all on the same plane and equal? Yeah.
The training that they go through to achieve these categories, doesn't that sort of expand the category that they eventually end up in?
No, that initial training
yeah.
is just to get their self spun up enough that basically that raw, you know, starting self that has just its initial limited relationship to experiential deity, you get it spun up and you find it has a certain flavor.
Oh, okay.
Okay? In order for them to, you know, in order for a supreme seraphim to eventually function as an administrator seraphim, they have to develop a long, long accumulating relationship with experiential deity. You know, roll some more experiential deity relationship into their being. Remember, this is much more than just learning a new trick. I mean, the energy system of their body is literally going to be different once they can function as a supervisor seraphim or an administrator seraphim if they started as a supreme. Okay, it's that the self is that literally different. You know, that initial self cannot be taught how to do planetary helper stuff. All it can be taught to do is supreme seraphim stuff. Say, okay? No matter how much you initially try, you can't train them to do some other job. Okay, so I mean it's the same way. I mean I can spend endless years, you know, in music programs and playing in bands and whatnot, and I still can't learn how to play the trombone with any proficiency. Okay, I mean, because my initial self is not teachable in that way. Doesn't matter how much I apply myself at it, it just can't be taught that stuff. You know, and it's really, really definitively that way when you're talking about these seraphim. Just, you know, think about how many years is involved in that initial training regimen that we read about. You know, and with the best teachers that the universe can offer, they're not teachable. They're completely dense in those other areas. Okay, but that's the power of experiential deity. You give it some time, bathing in experiential deity, rolling around in the universe, doing all kinds of experiences, and experiential deity begins to modify you, begins to grow you. Your energy system literally takes on a different flavor, a different color, a different, you know, a different nature. And eventually, you can actually be taught to do another job. You know, eventually I will be able to be taught to do something musical with some proficiency, but not now. Okay? I need a lot more time bathing in experiential deity. All right, let's see, anything else there? I don't think so. Yeah, but you know, you see how they are, however, experiential creatures, see, and by experience. And I'm just stressing, remember that don't think about that so abstractly, think about it more literally. You know, literally accumulating experiential deity likeness, a stuffness within you that's of an experiential deity flavor. Okay.
After being commissioned, seraphim are assigned to the reserves of their inherent group. Those of planetary administrator status often serve for long periods as originally classified. But the higher the inherent function level, the more persistently do the angelic ministers seek assignment to the lower orders of universe service. Especially do they desire assignment to the reserves of the planetary helpers. and if successful, they enroll in the celestial schools attached to the headquarters of the planetary prince of some evolutionary world. Here they begin the study of the languages, history, and local habits of the races of mankind. Seraphim must acquire knowledge and gain experience much as do human beings. They are not far removed from you in certain personality attributes, and they all crave to start at the bottom, on the lowest possible level of ministry. Thus, may they hope to achieve the highest possible level of experiential destiny.
Okay, so a couple things there. You know, the one is sort of the little subtext. So, you know, it's a few hundred thousand years ago, and you have very excited supreme seraphim that sure enough they get the job they've been looking for to be assigned to the schools of Kalagastia and Urantia and learn how to become a planetary helper, only to get sucked into rebellion. They're now, you know, doomed to be exterminated at some point. Unless they saw the, you know, the light at some point. You know, and they tell you that a lot of seraphim, you know, kind of got sucked in, and, you know, they recanted, you know, as soon as they kind of were showed the facts a little bit better. But, you know, just think about, well, how cataclysmic, you know, you got this, you know, you can see all of the kind of idealistic, wide-eyed excitement, you know, that's between the lines of what they're talking about there, only to find yourself enmeshed in the orgy of darkness and death. So, you know, this is a tricky thing to go down to the lower levels, and you know, the other thing there about you know, they mentioned right there at the beginning about the planetary administrator, seraphim, often served for long periods as originally classified. Okay, see, so what's between the lines there? So those lower seraphim obviously are a little bit more matter-of-fact mode of consciousness. They don't have quite as much independent personality manifestation that can kind of, you know, work through them yet. So they don't have a lot as much foresight. You know, that's why they're more susceptible to getting sucked into rebellions, right? Their limited foresight. And so they can be much more, you know, content just chugging along in their little slab of the picture, you know, doing the day-to-day grind. But the, you know, they, as they point out, the higher the seraphim, the more they're by initial nature have a little bit more foresight, a little bit more personality dynamic to their consciousness, you know, and so they're starting to already think, you know, oh boy, paradise, you know, I got to figure out how I can get there. You know, whereas those planetary helpers are not initially thinking like that. So that, you know, that adds an addition to, when they say certain personality attributes there. Now, on the one hand, again, we mean personalized self attributes, but also this mode I'm just pointing out, you know, there's a contrast amongst mortals. Some mortals, just by nature, can have a little bit more personality consciousness going in this life. And that's a double-edged sword. It's going to be harder for you to be content with the very lowly nature of where you're starting here. It's nothing like Havona, but you'd love it to be. You know, so you're going to feel all kinds of tension because the world doesn't live up to your, you know, your fondest hopes and dreams. Whereas that other person that doesn't have as much foresight, doesn't have as much personality consciousness, completely happy, you know, as a pig in mud, and just chugging along through their life, okay? You know, whereas you're getting yourself all wrapped around the axle and probably commit suicide in despair. Right. Yeah, you know, so, you know, who got the short stick? Right? Right. I mean, it's... you know, that you know, it's just part of experiential creatures. It's not just morals. You know, they're trying to point out angels are very much like us in this way too. Some of them, you know, will just chug along in their little rote job and they're happy as can be, okay? It doesn't mean that in eternity they're any less of a person, but in that this little short little circumscribed bit of time, you know, they're not manifesting a lot of personality. Okay? And so those angels that are down lower and hence closer to interfacing with us in a more day-to-day way, isn't that appropriate? You know, that they don't have as much high-minded personality activity, because mortals can't have much anyway. You know, and so they can relate to us better. You know, some extremely high-level personality being, you know, just can't even comprehend what we're about, you know. So you need someone that's a little more animal-like, you know. There's no animal origin in a seraphim, but coincidentally, their selves, down at those lower levels, can synchronize with an animal origin being a lot better, you know. And, so they'll be helping humans to be content in their life. You know, that's one of the problems of the combination of the rebellion and the default with the spiritual uplift. Okay, we're in general can have a very high-minded consciousness because of the spiritual uplift, but we don't have the means to manifest it, and so it ends up being more of a frustration in many ways. If only I could, you know, make my mind do such and so, but you just can't, because you didn't get the biologic uplift, and the races aren't blended, and your mind is a massive pile of cross currents and confusion, and right, okay, and the personality just can't do much with that. But you can imagine doing something with it, and so it's frustrating. Okay, so a little less imagination in those lower angels. You know, they couldn't imagine, remember how it says that? They couldn't imagine that Lucifer could go astray. They didn't have enough imagination to imagine that.
Look who he is.
Right? Do you have enough imagination to imagine someone who seems to be squeaky clean spiritual candy on the outside not being that way on the inside? Can you imagine that? All right. And then one thing that, you know, that we won't be touching on a lot here is, you know, remember one of the jobs that's going on with all these angels, besides all these endless jobs we're going to be reading about, is getting assigned to be a guardian angel for humans. You know, and so any of these angels, you know, that might be, you know, a sun spirit minister or, you know, or something like this that we're going to be start reading about, you know, they're always trying to see if they can get recognized and chosen, you know, to go with humans, because that's, you know, that's the quickest ticket to paradise. You know, follow an ascending human who has a hold of a spirit fragment, and spirit gravity is pulling them up, and you just tag along for the ride and draft on them, you know, and get up to paradise. You know, to get there in another way is going to be a long, circuitous route. Some do, but that's the easiest way to get there. So, all right, let's read some more here.
1. Supreme Seraphim. These seraphim are the highest of the 7 revealed orders of local universe angels. They function in 7 groups, each of which is closely associated with the angelic ministers of the seraphic corps of completion.
Okay, just a quick, they'll explain that a little bit more as we go forward. If you don't remember, so you know, angels, when they do finally get into the central universe, go through a regimen on Seraphington, okay, and then some of them get inducted into the Seraphic Corps of Completion subsequent to that, and take on a much more ubiquitous functioning integrus mode in the wake of that. And they're functioning at a high level. They're worried about the long-term, big-picture issues in the universe of universes. And so not surprising, even though the seraphic, I mean the completion seraphim, let's just call them that way, the ones that are in the seraphic core of completion, even though the completion seraphim work with all the different types of, you know, all seven of these groups, they're obviously going to work most extensively with those that are working at the higher levels, the supreme seraphim. And so you'll see them mentioned, you know, frequently when we're talking about the supreme seraphim, because the supreme seraphim are going to be doing more things that are up there at the higher level. All right.
One, sun spirit ministers. The first group of the supreme seraphim are assigned to the service of the high suns and spirit origin beings resident and functioning in the local universe. This group of angelic ministers also serve the universe sun and the universe spirit, and are closely affiliated with the intelligence core of the bright and morning star, the universe chief executive of the united wills of the creator sun and the creative spirit.
Yeah, the very fact that they have sun hyphen spirit, that they've glued those two together, seems really appropriate that you, as they mentioned that last sentence, that they would be working for, you know, Gabriel in our case, you know, who's serving the two glued together, the two gods glued together. You know, and then just suns and spirit origin beings in general, like they're saying. It's like, okay. Now, the thing I'll just say right up front here, but you can repeat it to yourself in every one of these categories. By and large, when you read these categories, you're going, well, I don't know. I'm not sure I know exactly what they're doing. Okay. The problem is, in general, everything that a seraphim is doing is beyond our imagination. Okay? So none of these descriptions are going to be that illuminating. Okay? They're going to be kind of vague and fuzzy. They're just trying to do their best to give us an initial sense of the pattern that's going on here. Okay? And you notice that we're already into another set of seven. Okay? You know, for each of these seven main categories that we had in the preface, we're going to go through a sub-categorization that's sevenfold. You know, and again, it's another one of those ways that the Paradise Trinity is sevenfold, like the seven circuits of Avona. So, again, you can scan through these set of seven and try to say, well, are the sun spirit ministers, are they tied to the first circuit? Are they tied to the seventh circuit? You know, which way does it go? You can start to try to see if you can see some pattern. Something that maybe is touches upon a crude enough aspect of the central universe that you might actually know about it. All of the minutia details are obviously beyond our awareness, and so we're not going to immediately recognize a lot of these patterns. But you always want to be seeing if you can. Maybe just notice it's sun spirit. The father's not there. We've got these daughters of the mothers, you know, when you're talking about angels, high and low. There's two of the infinite persons that also have experiential deity bound to their existential deity, the mother son and the mother spirit, right? Eternal mother son and the infinite mother spirit. You know, so they have a duality in that experiential deity that you see, you know, would glue these two together here. You know, what's the glue that binds the son and the spirit together? It's the mother. In this case again. So, and again, we're looking for sevenfold patterns tied to the Paradise Trinity. See, the mother comes from the Trinity. Just notice that that's always kind of in play in the background. Okay.
Being of assignment to the high suns and spirits, these seraphim are naturally associated with the far-flung services of the Paradise Avonals, the divine offspring of the Eternal Son and the Infinite Spirit. The Paradise Avonals are always attended on all magisterial and bestowal missions by this high and experienced order of seraphim, who are at such times devoted to organizing and administering the special work connected with the termination of one planetary dispensation and the inauguration of a new age. But they are not concerned in the work of adjudication, which might be incidental to such a change in dispensations.
That's the job of the, if you flip to the next one, you see their court advisors. Okay, if there's adjudication things, issues that and a seraphim you know, has an ability to deal with, they're just pointing out that's not, you know, this group doesn't do it. The next group of supreme seraphim and does, you know, takes care of those specific issues. Or maybe in just also, so you don't get confused, it might be incidental. That initially might be kind of confusing. You're going, wait a minute, I thought there's always adjudications tied to dispensations. What do you mean might be? You know, look closely at the sentence. The work which might be. Right? It's not the adjudications that might be, but the work that a seraphim, you know, might need to do in a certain thing. You know, and if there is such a thing, they don't do it. The next group of supreme seraphim do it. So you have to always look really precisely at the sentences, you know, how they're constructed. You know, and so here it is again. Just any time there's an obvious pairing of the sun and spirit, like the two glued together to make an avonal sun, a magisterial sun. Yep, there they are, helping them out. So see that by their self. Is a type of self that naturally synchronizes with the type of self that an avonal sun has. So they just work very naturally together. There isn't a lot of special training that has to go into it. They're right there on the same page with sun and spirit glued together, magisterial suns, avonal suns. And so they very naturally can help them. You know, see, so now you're starting to see, oh, it's not so coincidentally, you know, experiential deity knows that there needs to be angels that synchronize with avonals. So coincidentally, there are, you know, but existential deity wasn't trying to do that. It wasn't trying to micromanage the situation and, you know, make such a being. It just, you know, that creative act trusts experiential deity to just bring what is needed into play. Can you live your life like that? Where you don't try to micromanage it beforehand, try to think everything out in advance and you know, arrange all the chess pieces in advance. You know, can you let go and trust, you know, that what is needed, experiential deity will bring into play? Can you grow, you know, or allow your faith to be grown into trust? Yeah. Or are you going to spend your whole life trying to micromanage because you're overemphasizing your relationship to existential deity and thinking that that's what you're supposed to do is be an injection into the process and tweaking everything. And your whole idea of God is biased that way. And your whole idea of angel activity is biased that way. And your whole idea of history is biased that way. And you know, like mankind's consciousness has always been. The fifth epical revelation is trying to teach us that's not the way it works. Okay? You just let go and let experiential deity play out. It knows the end from the beginning. Yep.
So what about the parsing and the impression?
Yeah, technically, the more genuinely far-seeing you are, rather than just far-extrapolating of yourself and absolutizing it, the more genuinely far-seeing you are, the more you can see the whole in spite of the space and time limitations, okay? And you can see that experiential deity will bring things together, and you can just stop hyperventilating right now, okay? And trust, right? Right. We use the word seeing, you know, to, you know, this is a way of, because, you know, we say foresight rather than forefeel, you know, just to make it more definitive that we are developing a perspective into reality. You know, that we see how it works. We see how the universe works. You know, if nothing, we remember that 5 years ago, when you were certain that there was no way it could come together, it did. Okay? Have you chosen to forget that and continue to live in fear? Or have you chosen to remember that, learn from that, trust the next time? Instead of constantly just using your faith to assuage your fear and hence never fear that faith never maturing into trust. You know? And you know, and the pair with that is, you know, is hope. You know, people who live in faith and hope, you know, and is a mantra to try to keep from hyperventilating. Okay? I mean, yeah, that's where you start with faith and hope, but the reason that faith exists is so it can mature into trust. And the reason that hope exists is so it can mature into assurance. They aren't ends in themselves, they're beginnings. They were given to you by the Father, the initiator. They're just your beginning, they're not your ending. Okay? If you never let your hope mature into assurance, you're forever a child. You know, think about the bias in Christianity this way. Christianity, because of Paul, you know, teachings, which were valid at the time, you know, are very fixated on faith and hope. Faith, hope, and charity. You know, and that biases all of our thinking about what God expects of us. Yeah, he expects you to start, but he expects you to continue as well. Faith, hope is just a start, not an end. It's not even going to get you out of the local system. It's not even going to get you to Gerizim. Okay? Trust and assurance are going to get you to Gerizim. So, you know, making that transition from what we got out of the fourth epical revelation into what you should now know from the fifth, that you're supposed to be about trust and assurance, not mere faith and hope. Yeah, see, undying hope is what? Assurance. See? You know, I mean, it's like, what's living faith? Trust. See, it makes all the difference to put that adjective in front of it. It's no longer mere hope or mere faith anymore. See? The stasis of existential deity gave you faith. It's not living. It's technically dead. You have to choose to make it living, to make it trust, you know, to come into relationship with a dynamic experiential deity, not the static existential deity. One must do something as well as be something, right?
So I was listening to this church show last night, and he was talking that the same two words, hope and faith. He was saying that hope is faith in action. So, well, faith, you know, it would become more active if you had the faith. But I wasn't connecting with it as much.
See, hope is faith in expectation, not in action. See, you know, but you'll delude yourself into thinking that that expectation in your inner life is actually action, and it's not.
It was okay? Like we have hope first, and then he said we put it into action, and then we have faith.
Yeah, or either way, okay? Either way, you know, see, that's the thing. I mean, they struggle with trying to come up with new rationalizations of their two words. Yeah. It's like, no, you need to add some more words. You need to add trust and assurance to your lexicon.
Yeah, it makes more sense.
Right? Right? I mean, you can act out assurance. You can't act out hope. See? You can't act out faith. But you can act out trust. You can do that. You can do trust. You can do assurance. You know, I have faith that I'm going to be okay, but I'm not going to take a step. Okay. Trust, you know, allows you to take a step. Okay. Yeah, you do something as well as be something. But, you know, that's again that existential deity gives you hope and faith. A relationship to experiential deity gives you trust and assurance. You know, and that's why they call it spiritual faith, but soul trust. Your soul is an experiential construct, not an existential construct. Okay? And it's living. If it's experiential, it's living. If it's existential, it just has the potential to live. It has no actuality of life, except in your imagination. You can imagine you're living in a relationship, you know, with nothing but your relationship to existential deity, but then you're going to be regretting the past, whining over the present, and vainly hoping for the future. Right? you know, I mean, why do you languish in futile yearning? Because you obey not the truth. See? You have to trust to obey the truth. Faith is not enough. Faith will allow you to know the truth, but it won't allow you to obey it. Trust, you need trust to obey the truth. Okay, so so there you have you know, the beginnings, and then you notice there's this subcategory. So let's see how this works here.
The stole attendants. Paradise of Onals, but not creator sons, when on a bestowal mission are always accompanied by a corps of 144 bestowal attendants. These 144 angels are the chiefs of all other sun spirit ministers who may be associated with a bestowal mission. There might possibly be legions of angels subject to the command of an incarnated Son of God on a planetary bestowal, but all these seraphim would be organized and directed by the 144 bestowal attendants. Higher orders of angels, Superniphim and Seconiphim, might also form a part of the attending host, and though their missions are distinct from those of the seraphim, all these activities would be coordinated by the bestowal attendants.
We need the next paragraph to really kind of get the full picture, but let me just, you know, mention the little issue in passing there. Remember how when we went through the regimenting of the angels, you know, into their various, you know, the groups and the companies and the battalions, etc. Okay, you know, remember the number 144 came up there. That's a company because this is actually a pair. You know, most of the time they don't specifically remind you that they're talking about a pair of angels, but almost always they are. You know, and so if they say 144, they don't mean half a company. They mean a full company. They mean 144 pairs. And I mean, we'll see as we read a little more. Every once in a while, just to remind us, they'll mention it's a pair, but by and large, they don't make it so pedantic. You know, that they repeat that every time. You know, they're expecting you to just remind yourself that angels, you know, work in pairs. Okay.
These bestowal attendants are completion seraphim. They have all traversed the circles of Seraphington and have attained the seraphic core of completion. And they have been further especially trained to meet the difficulties and to cope with the emergencies associated with the bestowals of the sons of God for the advancement of the children of time. Such seraphim have all achieved paradise and the personal embrace of the second source and center, the eternal sun.
Okay, so a couple of fun things. Okay, so here you see, it's not just sort of a, you know, kind of an off to a side advisory sort of relationship with the completion seraphim. I mean, they're very intimately involved in what's going on here with these supreme seraphim. Like we said up front, the supreme seraphim are going to be very much kind of mixed in with the completion seraphim in their both of their doings. So these bestowal attendants are seraphim that have gone all the way, you know, to paradise and come back. Lots of training, lots of integrity. Integrity. I should have that overarching, you know, the whole phenomenon with attending a bestowal mission, shouldn't I? Right, see, so I mean, supreme seraphim are going to be pretty integrous, but they're not rock solid. Completion seraphim are rock solid. So that's an important element. They're making sure that bestowal mission, you know, all the I's are dotted, all the T's are crossed. You got rock solid, integrous angels in charge of the mission. Let's see, what else we have there? Oh, and then that last little tidbit. The personal embrace of the second source and center, the internal sun. You know, you were looking for the Father probably to be, you know, the last part of that. It was kind of an initial emotional instinct. And then if you were trying to think it out, you probably would think the third source and center, because after all they said, you know, the infinite spirit in the first sentence of the paper. No, it's the last one you would have guessed. It's the second source and center. Okay, but why? Well, you know, it's more definitively solidifying this fullness of mother, son, mother, spirit. See? I mean, they don't need to be embraced by the infinite spirit. They come basically from the infinite spirit, okay? They were embraced in the womb, if you will. You know, they're by nature embraced by the third source and center. But by nurture here, they're getting embraced by the second and working with the son hyphen spirit ministers. So, you know, they've got the full, complete duality then because of that embrace. And just the sun aspect of the second source and center, the eternal sun and all of the eternal sun's sons doing sun missions, you know, synchronizing with that. So it's a complicated thing, that embrace, to really get them aligned up to be working with that descending mission of the suns doing, you know, what suns do, at the same time being synchronized in a special way with what the angels are up to, at least this particular sun hyphen spirit type. Okay, so you know, a slick little combination. And see, and what allows that one fact, the second source and center, to do that is because it's not just sun type deity. It's sun and, you know, it's mother hyphen sun type deity. It's got both the natures to, you know, to do that dual phenomenon. You know, so the embrace is twofold. Okay.
Seraphim equally crave assignment to the missions of the incarnated sons and attachment as destiny guardians to the mortals of the realms. The latter is the surest seraphic passport to paradise. While the bestowal attendants have achieved the highest local universe service of the completion seraphim of paradise attainment.
Okay, see, so the twofold, you know, there they mentioned getting assigned as, you know, I mean, initially you're just a guardian angel, you know, but if you get to, you know, have your, you'd be working directly with a third circler or the equivalent, you know, so that now you're a destiny guardian and you're on your way up, you know, following that ascender. So that, you know, that's, like we mentioned, that's one of the things that they're definitely looking forward to, get that lowest part of their experience in place, right down there with you in the trenches. But putting that aside, the biggie that they're looking for is being a bestowal attendant, you see. You know, and while the bestowal attendants have achieved the highest local universe service of the completion seraphim, so in this first group of the first of the highest type of, or highest order of seraphim, you know, you see this subset of the highest local universe service, you know, coming out. That which, see, makes complete sense. You know, that's the most ceiling dweller thing that's going on here. All right. So now, you know, that whole bit about, like they mentioned, the adjudication stuff. Where does that come in?
Two court advisors. These are the seraphic advisors and helpers attached to all orders of adjudication, from the conciliators up to the highest tribunals of the realm. It is not the purpose of such tribunals to determine punitive sentences, but rather to adjudicate honest differences of opinion and to decree the everlasting survival of ascending mortals. Herein lies the duty of the court advisors, to see that all charges against mortal creatures are stated in justice and adjudicated in mercy. In this work, they are closely associated with the High Commissioners, spirit-fused ascended mortals serving in the local universe.
Remember, we went through them. We were going through the various local universe personalities, the High Commissioners, that spirit-fused mortals that have gone through the whole long, elaborate, bit of experience and finally get all the way to being High Commissioners. And, they started with race commissioners, and so they know, the details right down at that level. See, so very important that they would be working, in these, especially in these issues of adjudicating mortal survival issues, making sure that your facts are fully known before the court, as it were. Now, you have to kind of chuckle a little bit when they say, such tribunal, it is not the purpose of such tribunals to determine punitive sentences. It's like, okay, yes, but you did start out by mentioning the conciliators. So maybe you need a little asterisk next to that. Sometimes there's some punitive things going on, but obviously, in general, the point is not to have trumpets blasting and things that make even high beings scratch their heads about whether or not that's a valid thing to do. Go on. I mean, most of the time, it's just like they're saying, you've got a definitive contrast that needs to be worked through. Bob thinks about it this way, and Betty thinks about it this way, and it looks like, 6 and 1, half a dozen other, no one can figure it out. So you get someone with a higher perspective, to help decide between the two. Okay, so that's going on all the time. And so in general, it's more of a passive mode, you might say, of just helping to keep the system all coordinated. We have to experientially learn whether to do mode A or mode B, in a given situation. We don't all, including high beings, don't come prepackaged knowing that it's A instead of B. We have to all work through that. So that's, we've seen this many times, and that, I think for new readers, that's kind of one of the tricky things to sort of come to terms with, all the discussion of courts and adjudication and all of those doings. Your spiritual consciousness, has lots of imaginings that, you're going to wake up and be liberated from the difficulties of adjudication and a jury of your peers, deciding such and so, but it's literally sort of just the opposite. The only reason we have that on earth is because it's a downstepped expression from above. So you're not escaping it, you're moving towards the source of it. It will become better and better as you go up, and you'll more and more appreciate the truth that's here in that mode, despite the factual limitations. Even though a particular ruling might not seem to be appropriate, in our ignorance and attempt to adjudicate ourselves, there's a truth to the phenomenon, that's important, that needs to be part of the temporal process. We need to work through that. You can't impose your existential idealism on that and demand that every ruling have some sort of absolute perfection to it. You're missing the whole point of the domain in which you live. You're taking yourself out of the experiential domain. You're wanting to live in Havona, and there's no spaces left in Havona. That uncountable number of beings have every single spot filled in existential, eternal perfection. Your job is to be out here trusting the experiential process, and that there's a truth that flows through even the most grotesque of facts. Okay, and it's very hard for our idealistic consciousness to believe that. It is. The most primitive, crudest, phenomenon has a thread of truth flowing through it. in the midst of the battle axes and the death, there's a truth that flows through that. And you have to begin to trust that it's there, knowing that you can't even remotely see it. You can't expect to see it. And then because you see it, then you'll believe it. That's just not what our life is about. Blessed are those, right, who believe and yet have not seen. You know, and are you an agendonter or not?
Yes, we are.
Right? So, you know, if you want to assume the mantle of being an agendonter, stop expecting to be able to see in the facts the glory of Havona. Okay? See through the facts to the truth. All right.
The seraphic court advisors serve extensively as defenders of mortals. Not that there ever exists any disposition to be unfair to the lowly creatures of the realms, but while justice demands the adjudication of every default in the climb towards divine perfection, mercy requires that every such misstep be fairly adjudged in accordance with the creature nature and the divine purpose. These angels are the exponents and exemplification of the element of mercy inherent in divine justice, of fairness based on the knowledge of the underlying facts of personal motives and racial tendencies.
Remember the race commissioners say, you know, see that? You can see why those high commissioners are involved. Maybe just one little thing. I mean, that's all pretty straightforward, but notice they repeated it. Up there in that previous one, they said that their job is to see that all charges against mortal creatures are stated in justice, you know, and they and they repeat here, but while justice demands, you know, what exactly does justice mean? Okay, if you don't know what that word means, you know, God knows what the heck interpretation you're going to bring out of that those two paragraphs. Okay, to be just is what? It's to be law-abiding and honest. Okay, you know, they're going to see to it that what goes on is law-abiding and honest. Okay? And the honest part, that's pretty easy for your spiritual consciousness to handle. But the law-abiding part is much trickier. Because your idealistic consciousness is going to immediately imagine a more transcendent set of laws, thinking that anything short of the highest laws that you can imagine are evil. No, they're part of the evolutionary process. The law is the law. I mean, what did Jesus say? You know, he read the riot act to the Jewish leaders. You know, couldn't find, you know, harsh enough words, and then turns right to the people and says, but follow them. Okay? You don't have to follow them into iniquity. You don't have to follow them, you know, spiritually in your inner life, but in your outer life, they are the law, and you must be law-abiding, or there is not justice. Okay? And you're going, but they're so ignorant, and their laws are so arbitrary and crude. Okay. Yes, from your limited temporal perspective. But all law comes from where? From the source of law, from the first source and center, okay? It doesn't matter how lowly it is, how temporal it is, how fleeting, you know, it is. It's in some way a downstepped expression of capital L, capital A, capital W, okay? The first source and center of all things and beings. There is truth that flows through that. Evolution is creativity and time. Okay, so that challenge, you know, I mean, it's the fundamental challenge that the fifth epical revelation brings. You know, I bring this up all the time. Can you temper your spiritual consciousness? You know, to stop disallowing the validity of the evolutionary process. Okay, the evolution process is the Father's way. That benighted law is part of the times. It doesn't mean that you should grab a hold of something that is obviously limited and absolutize it and try to make it, function in the age of light and life. Okay? But it is what it is right now. Jesus said to the condemned criminal, we have no right to question this law that condemns you to death. That's a right of the evolutionary process at this point in time. I can minister to you in mercy, but the law decrees that you die, and that which you decide on earth is honored in heaven. Can you separate the two so that you don't end up in this mode like we were talking at the very beginning, where you become this schizophrenic phenomenon between your relationship to existential deity and your relationship to experiential deity? Your experiential deity is part of that benighted, seemingly benighted law process of this moment in time. And you conforming your mind to that law is part of synchronizing with the Supreme. If you try to only synchronize with a law that exists in your imagination, you have no relationship to the Supreme. And the fingers start to get farther apart, and you might slip through them. You're not going to be upheld. Okay?
Well, law is law, but then of course there was the Nuremberg laws, and Islamic states,
etc. Is it trivial to find the wisdom to figure out when you should be, working to, help with the advancement of law and when you shouldn't? No, it's extremely difficult to figure out when, but you must face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom.
Nazis did that.
Right? See, and so you can't judge these things atemporally, like your spiritual consciousness. That's a simple example. If the laws of the Nazis were absolutely verboten, then they never would have existed. They were allowed to exist for a time. Okay? We have our ideal set consciousness needs to face that fact. The universe authorities didn't short-circuit that before it began, any more than they short-circuited the Lucifer Rebellion before. It could have trivially stopped the Lucifer Rebellion before it started. Did they? No. They wanted the laws of Lucifer to rule, because in the fullness of the Supreme, that's part of the process. Without those passing laws of Lucifer, you couldn't get the Supreme. There's certain things that humans did in relationship to that you can't do any other way. And a lot of it is not what they did in the moment, which seems to be totally negative. It's what they do subsequent to that. Having conformed to those laws, they conform to the truth in a transcendent way that they couldn't have before. The inevitability. The inevitabilities. Those contrasts. Is altruism desirable? Then must, right? That part of the evolutionary process, that those contrasts are important. Those things your idealistic consciousness just can't comprehend. That's why you need your material consciousness to teach it. Anarchy is never appropriate. Jesus said, not one shred of revolution should you countenance in your mind. You want to conform with the times. You're part of these times. Live now. Don't live in the future. Live now.
Even though the law that's being stated is
totally is less than ideal.
Less than ideal.
Yeah, less than optimal. Okay? You have no idea how less than optimal it is. Think about how limited our idealism is. What if you had Jesus' mind? What if you could really, what if you knew the laws of Havona while you were living here? Seeing what Caesar and Pontius Pilate and Bob in this section was doing and whatnot, okay? Herod the contrast that he sees, but did he rise up against those laws? No, he He pointed their finger at him and you must conform to those laws. That's the challenge of the fifth epical revelation. Can you live now instead of idealistically then? Vainly hoping for the future. Thinking that these laws prevent me from doing what I could do. Well, you lack imagination then. I mean, you don't want to say that. You're admitting, you know, that you're ignorant. If you think that any set of laws prevents you from fulfilling, I mean, Jesus obeyed all the laws of his times. I mean, including not being able to draw pretty pictures. And he still got to be a first circler, didn't he? Right. None of those laws have any, you know, are any constraint. You know, except in your mind. Remember what it says at the end of 34? Except in the minds of ignorant, mistaught, or unfortunately over-conscientious persons. Those are the only ones who are limited by the limited state of the evolutionary process. Okay. The whole point of living on Urantia in the wake of a rebellion and a default is to have an opportunity to use your creativity like few beings get to. You get to use your creativity where in these very limited set of laws and societal norms, you can do great things. There's almost no beings in the universe that get that opportunity. Most beings would, you know, give their eye teeth for that opportunity. Okay, and then they look at us squandering it, vainly hoping for the future. And they're going, oh, for Pete's sake. You know, you've only got like 70 years or something. Don't squander your chance to do something great in that limited circumstance. You'll never have that chance again.
So just to clarify, we're supposed to be working with the laws of the land today. Everything that's laid out by the government, we comply, and it's not going to inhibit us. And we're supposed to go forward and emerge into our spiritual beautifulness, or whatever you want to call it, regardless of them,
yeah. And the only qualification on that, if you, having been put through an educational regimen, discover that you have a kind of a self that has a lot of innate abilities to work in wiser law formation, then you should get involved in lawmaking and work with the evolutionary process to move forward. But if you discover that you have no idea how to even go about such a thing, okay, then you know you are to live in the times. Okay. What's the other option? Spending your whole life railing against the system?
And you say that they're honored in heaven. What was that phrase again?
That which you decide on earth is honored in heaven. It's there in the Jesus papers. The whole point is if humans have done their best to make decisions that they think serve the greater good, that's honored in heaven. There's no existential absolutist judgment about it. It's like, well, that's less than what they do in Havona. So, you know, I'm not going to honor that. No, that's not the way it works. They honor the evolutionary process. I mean, remember how the revelators long for the great glorious times when Blue Man and the Andites were hacking each other with battle axes? Yeah, you remember that startling statement in the book, and you're going, what? Ah, yes. It was a glorious age because they were doing something. Now we've got a bunch of idealistic blobs that lay there and try to bliss out and vainly hope for the future. Okay?
But that's also part of the times.
Yeah, that's Congress.
We're born into these times where there is this in each person, there can be this much differential. I mean, you're born what you are.
Yeah, right. See, but that's what I'm saying. I mean, again, it's not a simplistic thing. I mean, you may very well be, you know, it's appropriate for you to be thinking about the limitations of the current legal system in a certain area. But remember, it takes almost no intelligence to find fault. It takes, you know, genuine brilliance, you know, wisdom to actually find a solution, okay? I mean, obviously, the current tax code is abysmal, okay? Who in this room has the wisdom to construct a whole new one that will lead to a stable society? I mean, it's trivial. It's trivial to see how, you know, benighted it is, how foolish it is. But do I have the wisdom to reform it? No. Okay. So I have no place there. The only relationship I could have to that area is an anti-relationship to it. Okay. And that makes me worse than it. I dedicate my life to contemplating how benighted it is and screaming about it. Now I'm worse than it. I've wasted my whole life. Okay? I mean, we have to recognize where our place is. Are we a, you know, supreme seraphim? Are we a supervisor seraphim? Are we? I mean, what were we put here to do? We were never put here to be an anti anything. You were here to be a positive something, not a negative something. What is it? What were you put here to do? Find your positive mode and do it well. You know, go through all of the training like a seraphim does so that when they do something, they do it well. Don't just sit there, you know, and poke, you know, holes in it. you know, if you don't like the way things are going in Palestine, go there and make it better. Because it takes no intelligence to notice the limitations there and to write blogs about it, okay? You know, if you don't have the wisdom to take those peoples forward, let it be. That's not what you were put here for. Figure out what you were put here for, something you can do positively instead of an infinite number of negative things that don't amount to anything. You know, do something positive. Okay, let's see. Right, so yeah, we brought up the justice thing. So, let's see. You know, maybe just mention, you know, they're telling you that these are involved in mercy. Remember that, we'll come back to that. Not tonight, but as we continue to go forward here. I'll show you some patterns.
This order of angels serves from the councils of the planetary princes to the highest tribunals of the local universe, while their associates of the Seraphic Corps of Completion function in the higher realms of Ravantan, even to the courts of the Ancients of Days on Yversa.
Ah, so here they are paired up again. You know, how are they working really closely with the Completion Seraphim? So you see here it's in kind of a hierarchical way. The Completion Seraphim are doing this court advisor stuff at the higher levels, and then the non-Completion Seraphim are doing it at the lower levels. So it's a very kind of straightforward symbiosis in this case. All right.
Three universe orientators. These are the true friends and postgraduate counselors of all those ascending creatures who are pausing for the last time on Salvington in their universe of origin, as they stand on the brink of the spirit adventure stretching out before them in the vast superuniverse of Orvantan. And at such a time, many an ascender has a feeling which mortals could understand only by comparison with the human emotion of nostalgia. Behind lie the realms of achievement, realms grown familiar by long service and Marantia attainment. Ahead lies the challenging mystery of a greater and vaster universe.
Yep. So you see, again, there's a whole bunch of things that these beings do that they can't even remotely try to explain to us, but they're trying to find things that, you know, we can identify with in some way. You know, think about how they said in the last one. yeah, so same thing here, just trying to give you a little sense of what they're up to.
It is the task of the universe orientators to facilitate the passage of the ascending pilgrims from the attained to the unattained level of universe service, to help these pilgrims in making those kaleidoscopic adjustments in the comprehension of meanings and values inherent in the realization that a first stage spirit being stands not at the end and climax of the local universe Barancha ascent, but rather at the very bottom of the long ladder of spiritual ascent to the universal Father on paradise.
All right, so they work with you in that very difficult transition where you think you're hot stuff, made it all the way to Salvington, and they try to gently break the news to you that you're at the bottom of everything. you're at the very bottom of the long ladder. Okay. You know, and that long ladder, remember when we were going through the central universe, you don't even have any imagination of just how long that ladder is until you're done with the third circuit of Avona and you get to the second circuit and you see this exponential hill looming before you that goes from supremacy up to absoluteness, and you're going, I'm supposed to climb that? I can't even see the top of it. You know, and they said, wait till you get to the first circuit. You think vertical is steep. Right? Wait till you see transcendent vertical steepness. Right. We can't even remotely imagine how far it is that we have to go. Even when we've gone all the way through, you know, all the years it's going to take us to get to Salvington, and we're a first stage spirit, we're still clueless about how much lies ahead of us. So, see, that wisely experiential deity has made it so that there are beings that are just innately able to synchronize with that space we're in. You know, are attuned to it by nature and can help us very naturally to reorient, see? That, you know, we've kind of touched upon that. There's beings that help us with that all the way up. It's a really tricky one to get you reoriented once you've found the Father. You know, to rediscover the differential and the hunger to bridge it again when it seems like you've reached the pinnacle of pinnacles. I've personally experienced the Universal Father. And then to have to come to terms with, no, you're at the very bottom of everything. To try to find the voltage again, to power you forward again. These angels try to, you know, you've gotten yourself all wonderfully integrated, and then they're going to reorient you so that there's a tension in you again. It'll power you forward. They're not going to let you be all nice and spherically symmetric and complacent. They're going to reorient you. See, an orientation is, you know, a sphere doesn't have an orientation. But something that's oblong does. You know, they're going to get you asymmetric again, you know, and get you going again.
Elliptical.
Yep.
Many of the Seraphington graduates, members of the Seraphic Corps of Completion, who are associated with these seraphim, engage in extensive teaching in certain Salvington schools concerned with the preparation of the creatures of Nebadon for the relationships of the next universe age.
Ooh, boy. Now, so the compatriots here of the Completion Seraphim are up to some really high orientation stuff. The next universe age. Can you think of a being related to you sometime in the future that might have doings with those Completion Seraphim as a finaliter? You can imagine you might have a lot of relationship with what's going on with these Completion Seraphim, because after all, as a finaliter, when you're out working, that's kind of what you're up to. You know, setting the stage for the next universe age. So that's the thing that, you know, if you remember that, that's a little less sort of just a factual statement and a little more of an intriguing personal statement, something that relates very personally to you. As I glanced down, there's this one other thing. You know, we were talking about trying to get you so you aren't spherically symmetric. You notice the word that they used about that kaleidoscopic, the adjustments, because they didn't want to use just like an ellipse. So, instead of a basketball, you're a football, and so now you're powered again. They didn't want something that, simplistic of an asymmetry, kaleidoscopic adjustment. So you're going to be asymmetric in just all sorts of different dimensions so that you have all of this complexity. See, of potential now again. All right.
Four, the teaching counselors. These angels are the invaluable assistants of the spiritual teaching corps of the local universe. Teaching counselors are secretaries to all orders of teachers, from the Melchizedeks and the Trinity Teacher Sons down to the Marantia mortals who are assigned as helpers to those of their kind who are just behind them in the scale of ascendant life. You will first see these associate teaching seraphim on some one of the seven mansion worlds surrounding Jerusalem.
I won't totally give it away, but you might wonder why they italicized C like that. I'll just leave it there and let's read a little bit more and see what they're hinting at there.
These seraphim become associates of the division chiefs of the numerous educational and training institutions of the local universes, and they are attached in large numbers to the faculties of the seven training worlds of the local systems and of the 70 educational spheres of the constellations. These ministrations extend on down to the individual worlds. Even the true and consecrated teachers of time are assisted and often attended by these counselors of the supreme seraphim.
We'll say that last little sentence until I don't leave you dangling. Do you see why they italicized it? They said, there you'll be able to see them, but they may already be right next to you. It's a very intriguing little thing. It's kind of like, what the archangel builds up to at the end of the Celestial Artisan's paper, where he spends the whole paper until the very last end pounding on you with a sledgehammer to try to get you humble enough so that he can tell you what he's going to tell you at the end, which he knows could be very problematic if you aren't humble. He's going to tell you that muses aren't just a myth, that there actually are muses, that attend the very best artists and foster their manifestation. That obviously could go to a person's head if they're too egotistic, as we were talking about earlier. See, it's a similar thing here. Look at this, they actually could be assisting really significant teachers on a mortal world. Kind of a fascinating little thought, but you won't get to see them until the next life. We all remember the whole bit about how you're always teaching those that are coming up immediately below you, but you might forget this, that you've got these angels, that the way their self is structured, they're just perfect for helping you with that, to be a better teacher to those who are coming up below you. So if you've thought about that bit of being a teacher all the way as you're ascending and wondered, I don't know if I can be a teacher, well, remind yourself of this. You're going to have these perfect helpers that will synchronize with your mind and kind of catalyze it so that it works better as a teacher mind. They will work very intimately with you so that you know how to put together just the right examples and sequence of words to awaken a recognition in a fellow ascending mortal's mind. All right, and then that little footnote they throw in.
The fourth creature bestowal of the Creator Son was in the likeness of a teaching counselor of the supreme seraphim of Nebadon.
Remember that? When he did his fourth as a seraphim, it was one of these. You know, it's very much like, you know, he who would be greatest among, you know, must be server of all, sort of thing, you know. To, you know, he put himself in that mode where he is teaching, very humbly teaching, you know, helping mortals to teach and others. All right.
Five, directors of assignment. A body of 144 supreme seraphim is elected from time to time by the angels serving on the evolutionary and on the architectural spheres of creature habitation. This is the highest angelic council on any sphere, and it coordinates the self-directed phases of seraphic service and assignment. These angels preside over all seraphic assemblies pertaining to the line of duty or the call to worship.
That last little bit, call to worship, is kind of intriguing. You know, it isn't all just the regimented line of duty stuff. But notice there's something curious here, and we won't fully understand until we continue next time. But you're going, well, wait a minute. This group is not sort of naturally here. They're picking 144 pairs out of it, and it fits here. What's up with that? It's almost like there's an empty hole, an empty slot here that gets filled by this, you know, director group, you know, which is culled from the other groups. Keep that, and we'll pick up on that little mystery there when we go get into the superior supernafim. All right.
Six, the recorders. These are the official recorders for the supreme seraphim. Many of these high angels were born with their gifts fully developed. Others have qualified for their positions of trust and responsibility by diligent application to study and faithful performance of similar duties while attached to lower or less responsible orders.
Okay, so now with the recorders, remember we've touched upon the recorders many times as we've gone down through all the hierarchy of angels. See, now they're a group that are apart. You know, you have this whole hierarchy of recorders that are working up. You know, the lowest recorders become proficient and move up to the next higher group of recorders, which move up to the next higher group of recorders, etc. You know, that's a very specialized group. Their destiny, if you will, of service is not to, you know, kind of explore horizontally into all these different areas. You know, they're just moving up very definitively through that hierarchy of recorders. Okay. They have very special skills. Okay. Not any old angel can do a recorder thing. Okay. It isn't just anyone that can hold a pen. Okay. That's one of the types of or categories of angels, you know, that you don't want to think of so much of, you know, I'm going to be a recorder for a while, and then I'm going to go over and do this, you know, the sun spirit thing, and then I'm going to go be a voice in the garden. And okay, they're much more just moving up the recorder ranks. Okay, so they have they're a type of angel that is kind of more has more circumscribed, specified skill set, you know, that is meant to just be advanced vertically rather than broadened horizontally. Okay.
Seven, unattached ministers. Large numbers of unattached seraphim of the Supreme Order are self-directed servers on the architectural spheres and on the inhabited planets. Such ministers voluntarily meet the differential of demand for the service of the supreme seraphim, thus constituting the general reserve of this order.
So that's kind of interesting. See, at this highest level, the reserve isn't sort of just a, you know, a bunch of angels hanging around waiting for an assignment. They're in very active mode while they're in reserves. There's all kinds of sort of just odd job, the things that need to be done. And so they're very dynamic, you know. So they're in a reserve, just out there, fully in service. That's a little bit different than what you see, you know, with in other circumstances. You know, so again, you know, seeing how they're self-directed servers. Again, the reason that it can be like that is because they have this most definitive personality mode that they're in. Can be more self-directed. They can just go out there and they can recognize, oh, there's this thing that needs to be done here, and there's this thing that needs to be done over here. You know, and there isn't a whole category of angels that's assigned to do that. That's why I'm here. You know, that's my job. So you don't have that level of self-directed awareness, you know, all the time. But it's not surprising, because again, you know, just to finish it up, remind yourself of what this category is: supreme seraphim. They obviously, by nature, can really see the big picture. And so they're indispensable to, to seeing the things that other more circumscribed angels will miss. You know, there'll be a little divot that they won't notice, but these very detail-oriented angels will notice that little spot that needs, you know, someone to step into. All right, let's end it there and then take a moment to reflect on that.